News from Antarctica, and it's not good. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. There's no way to sugarcoat the latest from climate scientists.
The news is that Antarctica is melting 3 times faster now than it was a decade ago, which means it's sending more than 200 billion tons of ice into the ocean per year.
But the flood of bad climate change news can be hard for many of us to connect with.
It's global, it's long-term, it's very complex, as well as this issue of it having quite threatening implications for tackling it in terms of people's lifestyles.
And in sports, only one story really, World Cup soccer.
But I can't wait, Marco, I can't wait. I've been waiting for this my whole life.
Plus, rediscovering the sounds of the Arhu thousands of miles from home. Today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. A happy Friday to you. And for those celebrating Eid Mubarak, the Muslim holiday Eid al-Fitr begins today. For those of you who've been fasting through the daylight hours for the past month, now begins a month of celebrating. So, to quote my mom, eat. Speaking of eating, in a few minutes we're going to meet a climate scientist who's changed what he eats to help bring down his carbon footprint. He and his family have also dialed back their driving, their flying, a whole bunch of stuff that a lot of us might be able to do as well. But we're going to start with a little bit of why we might want to do that. It's news about Antarctica and a new report that it's melting way faster than it was just a few years ago. The World's Carolyn Beeler is here from our Livable Planet desk. The news is pretty daunting, isn't it?
It is, Marco. The news is that Antarctica is melting 3 times faster now than it was a decade ago, which means it's sending more than 200 billion tons of ice into the ocean per year. That corresponds to about 0.5 millimeter of sea level rise a year just from Antarctica. That's not including Greenland or anything like that. And it's largely coming from just 2 huge Antarctic glaciers.
I have to imagine this is a really big deal.
It is. This is the most definitive number we have yet on changes to the rate of ice melt in Antarctica. It was done by 80 scientists from all over the world, and it combined 24 recent measurements of ice melt to give an especially comprehensive look at what's going on down there. That being said, it's important to note that just because we've noted a tripling of the rate of ice melt in the past decade, that doesn't mean that's what's going to be happening for the next decade. So this shows the past, not necessarily the future. But one of the report's authors, Pippa Whitehouse, pointed out even current projections for sea level rise are worrisome for a lot of us.
We have projections going through to 2100, and actually the sea level rise we're going to see is 50, 60 centimetres probably. And that is not only going to impact people who live close to the coast, but actually when we have major storm surges and flooding events, it's going to be exacerbated.
So, Carolyn, as you said, this study is especially comprehensive and its results are startling, to say the least. But I feel like there's a new scary news story about melting ice and sea level rise practically every month, maybe even more frequently than that. For example, this is a compendium of ominous headlines just from our show. The massive West Antarctic ice sheet is starting to collapse.
The glacier's melt rate has doubled since the 1990s.
The ice sheets aren't melting in a gradual, linear fashion.
Antarctica is losing ice twice as fast as it was just 4 years ago.
The ice shelf could become quite unstable.
When we hear all these stories, do we just become numb to them? Do we bury our heads in the sand? Or does this actually help understand climate change better?
There's more and more work being done in the fields of psychology and cognitive science looking at how we interpret and react to climate change news. And I think the first thing to point out, Marco, is that we as humans have not evolved to get super worked up about problems where the worst impacts may be decades in the future, or where the worst impacts are going to be felt far away from where we live right now. So it's kind of hard to make us care about this type of thing in general. I interviewed environmental psychologist Lorraine Whitmarsh from Cardiff University about this.
Climate change has all the hallmarks of an issue which is difficult for people to engage with psychologically because it's kind of global, it's long term, it has a lot of uncertainties attached to it, it's very complex, as well as this issue of it kind of having quite threatening implications for tackling it in terms of people's lifestyles.
So if this is not something we're predisposed to caring about, does hearing this news over and over affect us?
So interestingly, a lot of the studies that have been done looking at how we interpret negative news that might impact us are from the realm of public health. And what that work shows is that fear tactics only work to spur us to action or get us to care in very specific contexts. So contexts in which we know exactly what we can do to reduce the risk we're being told about, so giving up smoking, for example, and where making a change in our life isn't really threatening to our lifestyles. So neither of these is true about climate change. And so Whitmarsh says if we hear scary stories or campaigns that use fear tactics about climate change, we often tune out.
This is why it's really difficult to use fear for climate change, because actually, individually, our sense of being able to tackle climate change is pretty low. Secondly, the sorts of things that we're being asked to do are often things people don't really want to change or give up.
So what does convince us to change our behaviors?
Well, it's not images of polar bears on melting ice caps, because we can't relate to that. It doesn't relate to our lives. What does tend to work is understanding how climate change might impact our families, our favorite spot on the beach, our jobs. And in terms of things that get us to actually take action about climate change, the research says what's key is to appeal to our own self-interests. Here's Whitmarsh again.
I would say sometimes we don't even need to talk about climate change to persuade people to take action. The most effective way to get people to change behavior is to appeal to what is important to them.
So, for example, the research shows that if you want people to save energy, tell them it's going to save them money. If you want them to eat less meat, tell them it's good for their health. If you want people to cut down on how much they drive, tell them it's going to be good for their neighborhood.
The World's Livable Planet reporter, Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much for this.
You're welcome, Marco.
So what exactly can one person do if they want to lower their carbon footprint?
Quitting planes was the biggest for me. Freeganism actually was the second biggest. That was getting some of my food from, you know, the food that supermarkets throw away, becoming vegetarian, bicycling more and driving less, composting, and then driving on waste vegetable oil and growing some of my own food.
Peter Kalmus is a climate scientist in California.
I'm using 1/10 as much fossil fuel as when I started out making these changes. In my mind, this is the most urgent crisis facing humanity. So it feels great to be doing everything I can about it.
You're a climate scientist, Peter, and we should mention you weren't involved in the Antarctica study we were talking about earlier on the show. But obviously, you've known for a long time about carbon emissions and how they hurt the Earth. Was there a specific moment, though, or a breaking point that you reached that made you decide to change your lifestyle?
Right. Well, I've had sort of a long path toward becoming a climate scientist. I started out in astrophysics and I started learning about climate change. And it was kind of a really unpleasant wake up call for me. And I kept reading more and more about it. And I eventually realized I had to switch into atmospheric science and start studying it full time. What caused me to change my life so much? You know, I think a lot of people feel the need for urgent change and aren't really aware of how to go about doing it. And I was certainly like that for several years. And I was kind of shaking people by the proverbial lapels and telling them we need to stop burning fossil fuel. And then I realized, hey, you know, I'm not actually doing that myself. So maybe I can reduce my own use of fossil fuel.
Well, you wrote a book about your whole experience changing your lifestyle called Being the Change. And we just heard that doom and gloom descriptions of climate change don't actually work to make people change their behavior. But examples of how actions that will help the climate can also help us personally, can make us change our behavior. Was that part of the reason you decided to write your book instead of just changing your lifestyle?
Right. Well, that was one of them, is that I didn't see this message getting out very much that, you know, if you make these changes and burn less fossil fuel and emit less carbon dioxide, it wouldn't necessarily feel like a horrible sacrifice or like you were putting on a hair shirt, that there was a lot about it that I liked that I would do even if there wasn't a climate emergency, like the biking, like the gardening. I converted a car to run on waste vegetable oil. I'd probably just buy an electric car now, but back then that wasn't a viable option for me. So I really enjoyed all of these things.
You come to a conclusion, though, that the world population approaching 8 billion, your individual reduction obviously can't solve global warming. I mean, I interviewed a well-known environmentalist some time ago, and I asked him if he'd gotten an electric car or if he was reusing plastic bags or changed to LED light bulbs. And he said, yes, he does, but the real need, he said, is for a complete recalibration of the global economy, which does not seem to be happening. So are all these changes symbolic at an individual level?
What I'm doing is trying to push for a cultural shift. You know, I think that we look to our neighbors, our friends, our coworkers, and we kind of cue our behaviors off of them. And if no one is moving away from fossil fuel, that's not going to be something that we imagine. That's not going to be something that seems realistic to us. And it's not going to be something that we know how to do. So, you know, we need systems level change. I'm a huge advocate for making fossil fuel more expensive by putting a price on carbon, which is starting to gain some bipartisan support. But until there's a cultural shift and people really start voting on climate as an issue, it's very, very hard for elected officials to start making those changes.
Your decision not to fly is what's gotten the most attention and may be the hardest for a lot of people to go cold turkey on. It seems like even people who consider themselves environmentally conscious and otherwise find it hard to stop flying. Remind us how big a carbon footprint flying creates, like in your own time flying.
When I started making these changes, I was burning about the same as the U.S. average, which is around 20 tons of CO2 per year. And for me at the time, this was in 2010, flying was about 3/4 of my footprint. So
wow.
It was, for me, it was huge. And I had no idea until I sat down and looked at how my, you know, daily decisions were emitting CO2. And I quantified that. It didn't take me that long. And I talk about how to do that in my book. You know, I'm not calling for other people to give up flying altogether. And I would still fly if there was a compelling enough reason to get me on the plane. But I just don't like the feeling of emitting all that CO2. And since 2012, there hasn't been something that was compelling enough to get me back on a plane.
Has that been difficult? I mean, do you miss travel? I mean, you could drive to Paris, but it would take a long time.
Well, you know, I still travel. I'm very fortunate to live in California. There's so much to explore here. My parents and my wife's parents live in Illinois. So about once a year, we either take the train or drive, sometimes on vegetable oil, to Chicago. And we camp along the way. And it's a wonderful adventure.
By the way, 20 tons of CO2 per year, is that per person for the whole country?
Yeah, that's per person per year in
the
U.S.
That is insane.
And in Europe, it's about half of that. So I feel like there's a lot of low-hanging fruit for people in the U.S. to reduce their emissions. And then, you know, it's kind of like bicycle infrastructure. If no one's riding a bike, your city's probably not going to be that eager to put in bike lanes and bike paths. But, you know, it's like a chicken and egg thing. As more and more people start demanding alternatives to the fossil fueled infrastructure and the fossil fuel way of doing things, I think the systems will start to catch up.
Yeah, power in numbers. That's called a revolution. Help us out here. Not everyone lives in a place where they can bike everywhere or can give up flying altogether. What first step would you suggest for people who may want to reduce their carbon footprint but kind of don't know where to start?
Right. Well, absolutely the first thing to do is to figure out how your actions are connected to CO2. For me, again, like I was all ready to put solar panels on my roof, which for me would have been a long payback time at the time. And then when I actually sat down, I realized that my diet and flying were my two biggest things. Everyone's going to be different. You know, I haven't met a single person in my life who doesn't burn any fossil fuel whatsoever. So it's I think it's important not to get too puritanical about this, but to think instead, you know, what are the big things that I can reduce? Mm. So hopefully people can find something that makes them happier and also reduces their footprint. And then that's a sustainable change. And hopefully they'll be eager to try taking the second step.
Peter Kalmus is a climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, though he's been speaking with us on his own behalf, not NASA's. He joined us from member station KPCC in Pasadena. Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up on the show next week, the UK has taken a big move to cut the carbon footprint of its entire country. The UK was built on coal. It fueled the Industrial Revolution and helped build a global empire. But now the country is kicking the coal habit.
It cannot be satisfactory for an advanced economy like the UK to be relying on polluting, carbon-intensive, 50-year-old coal-fired power stations. Let me be clear, this is not the future.
By 2025, the UK will no longer be burning coal for electricity. We'll have a two-part series from Carolyn Beeler and the World's Livable Planet Desk on that, the rise and fall of coal in the UK. That's next week here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. For the last 15 years or so, one man has dominated the political scene in Turkey. That's the country's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. But there's an early election a little over a week away, and it looks like Erdogan is facing his most serious challenge in years. So why does that matter to us? Take a listen to a little bit of video from my BBC colleague, Mark Lowen.
Well, it's because Turkey matters, and so who's in charge in this crucial country has worldwide importance. Turkey has the second largest army in NATO. It's a vital Western ally bordering Syria and Iraq. It's still a candidate for EU membership and one of the 20 largest economies, and it has a key role in the Muslim world. This election could cement President Erdogan in power or unseat him and radically change Turkey's direction.
The BBC's Mark Lowen there. Let's turn now to Zia Weise, a journalist based in Istanbul, and I asked her how Turks feel about Erdogan's bid for re-election.
There seems to be a lot less enthusiasm this time round. It might just be that people are tired of yet another election. But we've had a serious economic downturn in Turkey over the last year or so. So people are no longer feeling quite as sure that Erdogan is the person that should lead Turkey.
Yeah, so tell us about the opposition. Do they have a common candidate or do they have some plan to give Erdogan a serious challenge?
So they do not have a common candidate. There are two major challenges. One is the secular opposition party's candidate, Muharrem İnce, and one is the nationalist opposition party's candidate, Meral Akşener. There are also smaller parties, but these two are Erdogan's biggest opponents. They have, however, formed an alliance and may put up a united front in parliament, because this is not only a presidential race, but also a parliamentary election.
And what are these two candidates saying about their views for the future of Turkey?
So both are promising a return to rule of law, to democracy, abolishing the state of emergency, releasing political prisoners. Muharrem İnce, for example, has promised to release the Kurdish party's presidential candidate who's currently campaigning from prison. Mainly, it's about democracy. They haven't really put forward a vision for, let's say, economy or jobs, because the central theme has been, you know, it's either dictatorship or democracy. That's how the opposition are putting it.
I mean, all that implies that the rule of law and democracy have taken a hit under Erdogan. How has the Turkish president responded to these two candidates?
Well, his argument is that measurements such as the state of emergency are needed to keep Turkey secure. He cites threats such as the Kurdish militant group PKK or the group that allegedly perpetrated the coup in Turkey 2 years ago, the Gulenists, as still present threats to Turkey's security.
So this vote happening in a little over a week is actually happening 18 months earlier than it would have. Erdogan called this election early. Explain why he did that.
So most people think he has called early elections because he wanted to hold elections before the economy, which was already floundering, took a major hit. Because Erdogan, for many voters, has become synonymous with a stable economy, with wealthy Turkey, and that's his central promise, but it's also his Achilles heel. If the economy is not steady, it's generally assumed that many voters might start to doubt Erdogan's ability to keep Turkey on that upward curve.
Reporter Zia Weise in Istanbul, thank you very much for explaining this to us.
Thank you.
Friday, end of another long week, the start of the weekend. And can I speak frankly for a moment and talk about a big reason why Fridays are great? Payday, right? That's really why many of us get a skip in our step on Fridays.
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro. Now, we count it this way because we like to pretend like we have more money than what we have, so we fold it so it can look like a bigger stack.
Cuatro, cinco, seis.
Cinq, six, sept, huit.
Tres, quatre, cinq, seis.
Chasse, chapte, opt, no.
Can do like this.
people around the world counting money and showing the ways they count greenbacks and how to carry wads of the stuff. It's from a video produced by Condé Nast Traveler as part of its quirky but compelling video blog. Many people from many countries, because don't you know, for many parts of the world, a cash economy still rules. That idea may conjure up a street in Senegal or India, perhaps, with hawkers rifling through stacks of bills. But turns out, you're better off imagining the streets right here at home in the U.S.
Start.
11. In the Condé Nast video, all the different nationalities are counting dollar bills, because when it comes to cold cash, the dollar is still the economic lingua franca of the globe. It's got a stability and status that many people would want for their own local currency. But it also sheds light on the fact that right here in the U.S., we are still much more of a cash economy than a lot of other countries. The Netherlands and France, for example, rely far more on non-cash transactions than the U.S. Places like Kenya, way more people there are using mobile phones to move money than here in the U.S. Only about 30% of Americans have done that, compared to 55% of Kenyans, according to the New York Times. Leading the pack, Singapore, where more than 60% of transactions are done without cash. And most economists predict that the rest of the world will ultimately follow that trend, including here in the U.S. In the meantime, remember, the Jackson 5 isn't just a band. It's also those 520s you might get out of the ATM this payday. Cold hard cash for the weekend. And don't forget to count.
19, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30.
I'm Marco Werman. It's the Muslim holiday of Eid, but not much to celebrate for families amid the war in Yemen.
The day after I interviewed them, it rained. And when I went back to see them, they had lost all of their food that they had begged from neighbors. Their clothes were completely wet, blankets were wet, but they couldn't leave. They had nowhere else to go.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In the Yemeni port city of Hodeidah on the Red Sea, it reached 100 degrees today. It was the first day of Eid, when most Muslims are celebrating the end of a month of fasting. But there was no partying in the streets. On the contrary, one resident told us people were trying to look for food and water. And they were being cautious. Houthi rebel fighters are patrolling the city. They've controlled most of Yemen since 2015, and ever since then, fighters from other parts of Yemen have been trying to drive them out. Today, fighting centered on the airport in Hodeidah. Residents saw this week's military assault coming, and many of them have fled over the past few weeks. Now they are what humanitarian groups call IDPs, internally displaced people. Sudarshan Raghavan was recently in southern Yemen, where he heard stories from IDPs. You've covered conflict before, Sudarshan, people escaping violence. What's different about what you saw happening inside Yemen right now?
What's different now is, unlike situations such as in Iraq, when people were fleeing war and conflict, many of those people would end up living with families or had some sort of support network to turn to. In Yemen, you're not seeing that because so much of the population basically has nothing. So what you're seeing now is tens and thousands of people who've been fleeing areas, particularly on Hodeidah, since December, actually. And they're literally going to fields, to unfinished houses, to wherever they can find some sort of refuge. You know, many of them live in these decrepit tents made out of blankets or tarpaulin or even cardboard. Others live in unfinished houses where they're living next to open sewage. I met one family who basically didn't have a roof. And the day after I interviewed them, it rained. And when I went back to see them again, they had lost all of their food that they had begged from neighbors. Their clothes were completely wet, blankets were wet, but they couldn't leave. They had nowhere else to go, so they decided to stay on in this roofless house. So this is the huge difference. People are fleeing their homes due to conflict, and they have nowhere else to go, no one to turn to, no support network, so they have to really fend for their own.
So the story of that one family that found themselves in that miserable hut, but I mean, there are also physical injuries that people are dealing with at the same time. You met a young girl who was in really dire straits.
I met one family who was fleeing their village near Hodeida, and they were heading down to the town of Hoka, a man named Hassan Issa. He was traveling with 10 of his relatives, including his teenage daughter, who was crying and her left arm was basically shattered and bleeding when they were on the run. Why? Because as they were leaving their village, their vehicle ran over a landmine, and that threw them all out onto the ground. His daughter, Rabab, basically had her arm, left arm shattered, as I said earlier. His pregnant sister-in-law was also in the truck, and she ended up losing her baby. And his mother-in-law died in the blast. And after the blast, you know, they managed to get his mother-in-law's corpse, the wounded, including his daughter, onto a military truck. They first went to Hoka. The clinics there didn't have a surgeon, didn't have an ICU. So they went to the next town, Moka, which is larger, but even there, the hospital was ill-equipped, didn't have oxygen, didn't have a surgeon. Doctors hadn't gotten paid in more than a year, and most of them had left the hospital. So they finally had to drive all the way down to Aden, which is a six-hour drive from Moka, where they ended up at the Hospital of Doctors Without Borders. And their Western surgeons amputated his daughter's arm above the elbow. She's only 13. She was basically in bed at the hospital in Aden. You know, she didn't have an arm, but she didn't fully comprehend what kind of impact this was going to have on her life. Mm. You know, she was talking about how she loved to jump rope without really understanding that she won't be able to jump rope again without help. It was an extremely sad situation.
Yeah, it's tragic, and the assaults continue. I know you were there a little bit ago, and you're following now what's happening in Hodeida in this assault. How does that military operation, though, fit into the overall humanitarian picture that you've been talking about?
Look, you already have what the United Nations calls the world's most severe humanitarian crisis. If the offensive in Hodeida continues on, and especially if it lasts over several months, the UN is predicting as many as 250,000 people could die, and the numbers could even be bigger. It literally be a humanitarian catastrophe, the likes of which, you know, the world hasn't seen in recent years.
Sudarsan Raghavan, the Cairo bureau chief for The Washington Post. A sad picture there in Yemen. Sudarsan, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
You can learn more about the Yemen war and ways you can help people there on the ground. Just go to PRI.org. Perhaps this is no surprise, but in the Netherlands, prostitution is legal. That's been true since the year 2000 when the Dutch government legalized sex work. It was part of an effort to provide protections for people working in an already flourishing underground sex industry. But despite the government regulation, human trafficking and exploitation are still a problem there. So a group in Amsterdam's red light district decided to try to fight it with a different kind of brothel. Venetia Rainey has the story.
Okay, yes, so we are inside my red light.
And we're going to do the grand tour.
Marcel Heyman is a board member at My Red Light, a social project in the form of a brothel. It launched last summer to great fanfare. It's run almost completely by sex workers, and its 14 rooms have been designed by the very women who use them.
I'm going to show you the most beautiful room with a pool and a bath.
All of them are decorated in dark purples, reds and gold. Once inside, he tells me there are also other more practical features the women insisted on.
They wanted their own safe in a room because, you know, the brothels, sometimes they don't have a safe. And then there are always stories of customers that suddenly weren't customers but tried to rob them, and then they're quite vulnerable.
But the most important feature of My Red Light is that the rooms can only be rented by women who've been thoroughly vetted to ensure they're not being trafficked, pimped or exploited.
Yeah, it's quite personal what you ask them, like, do you have a relationship? If you do, what sort of relationship? Blah, blah, blah. You can never ask directly, are you being abused? So you have to be subtle about it.
Marcel should know. He's a former sex worker himself. This vetting procedure is required throughout the red light district, but it's not always strictly followed. At My Red Light, the emphasis is on treating the women as entrepreneurs who run their own business, offering them whatever help they need to succeed. In a nearby cafe named after Mata Hari, Marcel introduces me to one of My Red Light's sex workers.
Nuria.
Nuria, nice to
meet
you. Hi, Marcel.
Nuria has worked as a prostitute since she was 15. I'm using her first name to protect her privacy. Due to a botched operation on her larynx, Nuria's voice is permanently hoarse, so we go to My Red Light's office to talk. She says in her 34 years as a sex worker, she's never been trafficked or abused. She says she chose this work because she enjoys it.
Principle for like, for independence.
When she turns 50 later this year and she retires from sex work, Nuria plans to work full-time in an administrative role for My Red Light. She says it makes sex work more dignified.
Well, for the women, for the sex worker, like a normal job.
At a chic apartment in the suburbs of Amsterdam, I meet another woman who rents a window at My Red Light. Jane, not her real name, became a sex worker 20 years ago and then stopped when she had a son. He recently moved out, so at 41, she's decided to start again.
Don't scream.
I won't scream. So what are you showing me now?
I show you the pictures how I work.
Okay.
As she scrolls through photos of her window outfits, Jane explains that she works full-time as a nurse. Sex work is just something she does on Saturday nights. She pays 160 euros to My Red Light and works from 7 p.m. till 4:30 in the morning.
I love sex, I love money, and I love to seduce men. I love the exhibition in it. And my rules, if I don't want them, I say, no, thank you. I will.
This freedom to do things exactly the way she wants is part of why she rents a room from My Red Light, as opposed to any other brothel.
This project is behind the woman who wants to work independent. She earns her own money, and there is nobody behind her who takes her money or who pressing her to do something what she doesn't want.
Still, My Red Light has run into some difficulties. Part of it's financial. Unforeseen City Hall restrictions have meant their windows are empty during the day. And they've struggled to stick to their policy of hiring only current or former sex workers, which has attracted criticism. They're also accused of being yet another attempt to legitimise an industry that many see as inseparable from trafficking and exploitation.
But it's not that these women are victims.
Marcel Heyman again.
I think that if somebody decides to do sex work, you can always look behind the decision and ask yourself, why do they choose for this profession? And then, of course, it can be poverty, it can be lack of other opportunities, but that's not the point. The moment somebody takes this decision, then they should be able to work in a safe and secure environment.
And that's what My Red Light would like to provide. For the world, Venetia Rainey, Amsterdam, the Netherlands.
In Peru tomorrow, all eyes will be on Russia. That's because Peru's national soccer team will be playing Denmark in the first round of the World Cup in Russia. Both teams go into the tournament on a winning streak, but the excitement is a new thing for fans of Peru. It's the first time in 36 years that the country has qualified for the World Cup. And for lifelong Peru fans, folks like Daniel Alarcón, this is the moment. Alarcón was born in Peru. Now he's a New Yorker. He teaches journalism, writes novels, and hosts a Spanish-language podcast, Radio Ambulante. The show's latest episode is called Peru Campeón, or Peru the Champion.
Recuerdo que me sonrojé. Al rato comenzaron a analizarme. Mi conexión emocional con la selección era un efecto secundario de haberme criado en los Estados Unidos. Todos estaban de acuerdo que...
So, Danielle, thanks for joining us. How anxious are you about tomorrow's game, Peru v. Denmark?
Pretty anxious, Marco. Pretty anxious, I gotta say. It's not every day you watch your country play in the World Cup for the first time, you know?
You've said the first World Cup you remember was Mexico, 1986. You would have been 9 years old. Peru had not qualified that year. What memories do you have about watching that tournament with your family?
I remember not knowing what it was and realizing by the, you know, adults around me that I was watching something really special. And then later I've come to understand that this is sort of like one of the ways that we measure the passing of time, you know? Every 4 years there's a World Cup, and every 4 years we pause and and take in the spectacle. And it was beautiful. It was beautiful. I remember Maradona, of course. I remember Argentina winning. I remember incredible goals. I remember individual plays and games and these heroes of yours that over the course of a tournament, you know, make mistakes and suddenly you sort of see their humanity. And it was a love affair.
There's one point in the episode where you quote a saying, "De todas las cosas no importantes, la más importante es el fútbol," which means of all the unimportant things, soccer is the most important. And let me just say, first of all, how philosophically deep that is, dude. but what does that mean for you?
Well, that's actually a quote from Jorge Valdano, an Argentine coach. And I mean, to me, you know, the things that give us, you know, pleasure and joy and the things that remind us how we were connected to other people, you know, that's what matters. And that's what the World Cup does. You know, this morning my son was Googling Vamos Egypt, like that in kind of this Spanglish, so he could say it in Arabic, so he could cheer on the Egyptian team because he really likes Mo Salah, you know. My son is not Egyptian. My son was just living this moment of rooting for a team that you know, he likes a player and making this kind of cultural connection. I don't know. It was just very, very special. And there's a number of moments like that that have happened in my life where I've sort of been forced to think about a country and a people and a place and a culture that I hadn't really stopped to consider. And you see the emotion on the fans' faces and you're like, oh, wow, they're just like me. They're, you know, it really is a beautiful spectacle.
For you, you left Peru when you were really young and then moved back for a bit after college. But today, is cheering on the Peruvian national team kind of your way to stay connected to that part of yourself?
Yeah, and I think there's for immigrants like me, and you know, I'm hardly the first person to stumble upon this bit of wisdom, but you know, your country or the country of your birth or the country where your parents are from, it can be a really difficult text to read. You know, you're always seeing it through other people's eyes. You're seeing it on trips that are short, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a week, through the eyes of your parents and other adults who may have their own sort of either rose tinted glasses or their own sort of, you know, anger at their country that no one's really contextualizing for you. And so the older you get, the more you realize how much you don't understand. And I think it becomes, there's something really special about rooting for the national team because you can do it unambiguously. You know, you can do it without a lot of context. You can do it in a way that expresses a love for a place that is very complicated, but renders it simple. And I think that's a really, really beautiful thing. I think, you know, and you're going to see during the course of this World Cup, many hyphenated Americans rooting for a team, particularly since the U.S. isn't in it, you know, rooting for the team where their parents are from or where they were born or where their ancestors hail from. And I think part of the fervor you're going to see is because of that, you know, is because of that way that it connects us to a place without us having to explain anything.
Well, may the best team win, but really, hey, we're in the right hemisphere. Go Peru. You can hear more about Daniel Alarcón's connection to the Peruvian national team on his podcast, Radio Ambulante. Daniel, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco. Enjoyed it.
The economic fight between the U.S. and China ratcheted up today. The Trump administration announced this morning that it's moving forward with tariffs on $50 billion worth of Chinese products. Beijing quickly vowed to retaliate, and President Trump promised to punch back again. The World's Jason Margolis is here. He covers trade issues for us. First of all, Jason, how many items are we talking about here, and what is on the list?
It's just over 1,100 items, and the list has a lot of manufacturing goods. I have it right in front of me. It's an exhaustive list, and it's very specific things like isotopes, not heading, 2844, spark ignition, reciprocating or rotary, internal combustion, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of things that are parts within bigger manufacturing apparatuses.
Right, stuff we might not understand, but which are probably important to a lot of industries.
Yes.
Now, economists generally don't like tariffs, so what is going on here?
Right. So, in fact, more than 1,100 economists sent a letter to the president, said, do not do this. And economists on the right and the left, conservatives, think tanks, liberals, they all agree tariffs are a very crude way of solving a problem. Now, many people agree, most people agree there is a problem. China has been taking advantage of our intellectual property, but tariffs are not the right way to address the problem. There are better ways, they say, work within the WTO, the World Trade Organization, work with your allies. That is the way to address a 21st century problem. Tariffs are a 20th century or earlier solution.
Now, in response to this imposition of U.S. tariffs, China, quote, called on all countries to take joint action, resolutely put an end to this outdated and aggressive behavior, and firmly defend the common interests of mankind. I mean, that's pretty dramatic statement. Who will these tariffs impact? All of mankind, as China suggests?
Well, ultimately, it's going to impact you and me. I mean, you think about it, if you put a tariff on a ball bearing, so that ball bearing is sold for a dollar and it comes into the port of Long Island, they tax it for 25 cents. That cost is ultimately going to get passed on to the consumer. That's the bottom line. Whoever pays last pays the most.
And who might these tariffs help?
Well, that's the question. I mean, President Trump thinks they'll help American companies, but most economists say it's the exact opposite, because a lot of companies in China that are building these things, they're actually American companies. They're subsidiaries of American companies. So you're hurting American companies, and you're actually helping your competitors in Germany and Japan, because now the Japanese company that builds ball bearings can import it from China to Japan to the United States, no tariff.
And that's what those 1,000 economists who wrote to Trump said.
Pretty much.
The World's Jason Margolis, thank you.
Thank you.
Finally today on the show, an audio postcard from Wen Li. She's a journalism student at Northeastern University here in Boston, but she's from China, and living far from home the past few years has given her a new appreciation for her country's traditional music.
The year before I came to the States, this music woke me up every weekend. It was my mom playing guzheng, a Chinese plucked string instrument with more than 2,500 years of history. Sometimes, when I miss her, I search for the songs she used to play. I think of the Chinese orchestra she joined. But I never expect to see one here, in Boston. That's the orchestra of the Boston Chinese Musicians Association rehearsing. The name of the song is Liu Sanjie. I've heard people sing this song in China, but never heard the Chinese orchestra version. It's beautiful and powerful, and suddenly brings me back to China and my home.
So every year we choose the different concert.
That's Zhan Taolin, the director of the group. Lin has performed all over, including at Lincoln Center in New York, and with cellist Yu-Yu Ma on his Silk Road project. The instrument Lin play is called Erhu. It sounds like this. The instrument dates back to Tang Dynasty in the 7th century. And though it only has two strings, it produces a beautiful melody and can convey a whole range of emotions. Lin said, when he first heard it as a kid, he was fascinated and touched by the originality of the sound.
But who really like a human? You feel a little sad, like you miss something.
That's Lin teaching Landon Turk, a 9-year-old boy. I asked him, why do you choose to learn Erhu?
Because it's much easier to learn the violin, and that's probably it.
Perhaps Turk hasn't really started to appreciate the beauty of Erhu, but his mother, Xiu Jin Turk, has always loved the instrument.
I grew up in Taiwan and I always loved the sound, oh my goodness.
She also feels that it is very important for her son to be aware of his cultural identity.
For kids who grew up in United States, I don't want them to forget where do they come from. So we just try to do the best we can to let them explore the culture that he is come from.
Besides guzheng and erhu, there are a whole variety of beautiful-sounding Chinese instruments. For example, pipa, also known as Chinese lute, is another amazing one. Because of my mom, I feel very lucky that I have the chance to immerse myself in a Chinese musical world. The music makes me feel relaxed. It's also a therapy, a healing for my homesickness. Try listening to just one piece, and hopefully you will feel the uniqueness, the power, and the beauty. For the World, Wen Lei, Boston.
What a pacifying way to close out this week. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you on Monday. Enjoy your weekend.
Public Radio International.